are listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
Thank you for coming today, and welcome to the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee event exploring a cybersecurity threat assessment. I want to thank our panelists for being here today, one who traveled rather far to be with us. It's great. Just a few housekeeping items before we get to the meat of our panel. As I hope you all are aware, we have a conference coming up in January. It'll be the fourth annual State of the Net Conference. We'll do about 6 to 8 different panel tracks covering a wide range of issues that will kind of preview what you'll see in the next session of Congress. In regards to today's event, we have a packet of one-pager position papers from members of our Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, so I suggest picking those up. There are a few that are missing here today, but they will be available on our website at netcaucus.org. So I will go ahead and do a quick introduction of our moderator, Mr. Brian Krebs. Most of you know him. He's the man behind Security Fix, which is a Washington Post blog, covers all things related to computer network security. He's broken some major stories on cyber scams, hacker attacks, and national security vulnerabilities. Most recently, he exposed a Russian conduit for cyber crimes, including child pornography, spamming, and ID theft. And from what I've heard, and I quote, he is a wicked good guitar player in his spare time. Thanks for being with us, Brian.
Great. Thanks, Danielle. And I want to thank the Internet Education Foundation for having me to moderate this panel. I've been asked, first I want to start by quickly introducing our panel here. I'm not going to get up here and read people's bios, just a real quick introduction. And then I've been asked to just give a 3 or 4 minute summary sort of state of internet and computer security, and what is it we're seeing out there to sort of frame this debate a little bit. To my left here is Greg Crabb. He's assistant director in charge of global cyber investigations for the U.S. Postal Inspection Service. We were supposed to have a couple of other law enforcement folks from the FBI and the Secret Service who couldn't be here today, so I'm really glad you can make it. Next to Greg, we've got Keith Rhodes. He's the chief technologist at the Government Accountability Office's Center for Technology and Engineering. And next to Keith is Gary Warner. He's a director of research in computer forensics at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. So what about the cybersecurity assessment? What are we seeing out there today in terms of cyber attacks, what's going on with the criminal groups? Well, we're seeing pretty constant attacks against our banking system. The biggest example of this is phishing, where criminals use email and spam to try to get people to go to fake bank and e-commerce sites and enter their personal and financial information. This is a pretty big problem. The experts we spoke to said that one phishing group alone last year stole more than $150 million from U.S. consumers and banks. Just to frame that a little bit, according to the FBI, all of the bank robberies in the country last year netted about $70 million, so less than half of what the one phishing group took. We're seeing constant attacks against the state and federal government IT systems, as well as military networks. Chinese hacker groups, some say with the tacit approval of the Chinese government, have pretty deeply infiltrated unclassified military networks, as well as the networks of a number of important defense contractors, stealing gigabytes worth of data and trade secrets. We're seeing constant attacks against our inboxes, as I'm sure everybody here knows. By some estimates, about 90% of all the email going around the net these days is spam. With the cyber attacks this year against Estonia, this is a country that's probably the most wired of all of Europe, we saw an entire country shut down, its electronic system shut down for a week or two because of these digital attacks being waged by spammers who control millions of compromised machines. We're seeing constant attacks against our stock market system. The culprit here are the pump and dump scams. These are things that the bad guys go ahead and purchase a bunch of shares in a stock they want to target. They spam out a whole bunch of fake press releases touting the stock. When the stock price goes up, they sell their shares, and all the legitimate investors are sort of left, without their shirts. we're seeing truly unbelievable numbers of home computers and business computers being hacked and compromised with software tools that criminals can use to remotely control these machines, to send spam, to attack others online, host phishing sites, actively steal financial and banking data. We're also seeing a disturbing evolution in the organized criminal markets that are buying, selling, and bartering this information. We're seeing the same criminal networks evolving into full-fledged services. So the creation of computer viruses, which used to be sort of these one-off things, have evolved into an organized marketplace where for a few hundred bucks you can purchase a never-before-seen Trojan horse program or a virus, and it is guaranteed to slip past any virus product on the market. And, oh, by the way, if one antivirus engine does detect it, you can buy update services so that they'll ship you a new version that's not detected. And finally, we're seeing the tools that we relied on to protect us, the antivirus software, the firewall software. These sort of things are becoming increasingly marginalized by the sheer volume and sophistication of these attacks. And I think that AV companies, antivirus companies, are now dealing with hundreds of new viruses a day. So I want to ask our panelists here, I think there's a perception amongst a lot of folks that that these cyber criminals who are doing this are still sort of these teenagers in their bedrooms or their parents' homes hacking away. Is that an accurate depiction, or how is that different from today?
I guess I can lead in. I don't know how I'm going to control my microphone here, but... Mike getting picked up on the microphone? Hold on just a moment. All righty, we'll share. Brian's just working, that'll work. Very good question, Brian. Sorry about the delay there. These hackers that we're dealing with today are not the youngsters that we dealt with in the 90s that were doing this for an exploratory venture into educating themselves about technology, but rather we're seeing an evolution into criminal organizations and making businesses of dealing with stealing identity information, breaking into computer networks to use them for their gain. And we've seen this evolution probably for the last 8 or 9 years, and every year we see more criminals from outside the United States gaining access to our computer systems to steal the commodities that they find useful, whether it's home PC of a user that's not protected themselves with the right precautions, or the identity credentials of bank account information, their bank account information, or their credit card information. And we see that these criminals are working together in networks as well, where individuals may be acting alone to steal some of these credentials, or they might be working with organized crime groups in Eastern Europe or West Africa. And in the Postal Inspection Service, we've engaged in a number of investigations into the criminals that are behind these schemes and worked with foreign law enforcement in such places as Nigeria and Egypt, in Jordan, and we spent a lot of time in Eastern Europe trying to build relationships with foreign governments to address the cyber criminals that are sitting there trying to attack us.
Anybody else want to touch on?
I guess in my experience, if you're finding someone in Fairfax County who's attacking your computer system because it's a snow day, that's someone who's trying to learn the craft. Yeah, there's a lot of noise out there and a lot of standard packages that are out there, but I would echo the points that are made. this information collection, this tradecraft via the internet, is a business. The folks who learn honed their skills 10, 15 years ago are now figuring out that, you know, this is entrepreneur time, and they'd like to make some money, and they've become very good at it, and the net is fragile, and the software is bloated, and nobody tests it completely, and so they're making a living at it. So it's not some kid wandering, you know, down into her or his living room and playing on the computer and eating pizza and watching The Simpsons all the time. There are people who do that. But there are some very methodical folks. Some of the people who have attacked us and some of the people that we've seen attack other departments and agencies when we're doing our work are very, very careful, very thoughtful, and they're not doing necessarily an automated attack that everybody assumes. You know, there's this wealth of automated tools out there that anyone can launch. We're seeing more and more people who are being very, very deliberate in what they do and being very quiet and being very careful in how they probe against a system. It's not, you know, the 1812 overture and they're coming in with the cannons blazing. I hope if one thing we can disabuse you of is that it's the 14-year-old with a lot of time on his or her hand.
I'll throw in one comment on that. The we called 2005 the year of the organized cyber criminal. Up until that point, there was clear evidence that there were certain organized crime families that were starting to play in cybercrime. But in 2005, we really kicked over the majority line, where most cybercrime was part of an organized crime or family. In 2007, it's the year of the automated cyber attack. What we're seeing now is it's no longer even necessary to have a human involved in setting these things up. Or if there is a human involved, it's a very limited engagement. For instance, creating a phishing site, it's now possible with a certain tool that we've seen to click make a new fish site. That's all you do. The tool goes out and does a search on the search engines and finds programs that it knows are vulnerable to attack. The tool automatically attacks one of those that's selected at random, uploads the phishing site from the criminal website to the site that he's just hacked into, unpacks it so that now that site believes it's a Bank of America fish, downloads a list of a million email addresses that it ought to send them to, sends out the advertisement of the new site customized to point people to that site, and waits for the money to come in. One click, make a new phishing site. The problem is that the criminals have all of these advanced tools. They've got people with software engineering degrees from MIT working for the Russian mafia now. What we're missing on the law enforcement side, we need that same level of automation. That one mouse click, make a new phishing site, was able to cause 20, 30, 100 hours of law enforcement time. If I click 10 times, I just burned 3 man-months of a law enforcement agent. We need to provide that level of tool on the law enforcement side. That's why I started at my position. We're doing research in computer forensics, specifically looking for ways we can help people on the law enforcement side do better analysis, because it's not just organized, now it's automated.
So great. In the face of all this evolution by the cyber guys, the cyber criminals, are the good guys evolving as well? How are the good guys, law enforcement, and our laws adapting to keep up with these changes? And I open this up to anybody.
I'll jump again. Well, I think we're seeing some things that are really powerful in information sharing. Information sharing is one of the keys to solving these things from the law enforcement side. I recently was in Pittsburgh for a meeting where we brought together the Anti-Phishing Working Group. I'm the co-chair of the Working with Law Enforcement Committee for the APWG. We brought the Anti-Phishing Working Group together with the FBI's digital fishnet for a meeting at the National Cyber Forensics Training Alliance, and we said, what do you have that we don't have? What could we be sharing that we're not sharing? And as an example from that night's meeting, we were able to share some information with the Royal Bank of Scotland about information that we knew was had been stolen from their customers. They were able to then turn around and take a list of internet addresses that tried to use these stolen credentials. So the FBI got permission to share with the bank some IP addresses or some user accounts that they knew had been stolen. The bank was then able to turn around and say, these are the computer addresses that we know tried to use these credentials. They gave that list of addresses to other banks. And those banks were able to put those addresses into a block list that prevented anyone from that computer being able to break in. Well, this kind of information sharing, now we have other banks who are starting to share IP addresses of known attackers with one another. We had a meeting with the American Banking Association just last week where someone from the ABA said, well, how could we share that across the entire organization? So as banks can share information, that's never happened before. If you've been attacked, you keep that a secret, right, until you're forced by a law to share it. But as they started sharing these addresses, they were able to prevent further loss and tie previously unrelated cases to one another. If my bank gets attacked and your bank gets attacked and the same computer address tries to steal credentials that were stolen from both of these attacks, now we can start doing some prioritization. There's tens of thousands of phishing attacks per month. How do you choose which one to investigate? Well, the one that's trying to break into nine different unrelated banks, maybe that's one that we should prioritize.
Gary mentioned the NCFDA. Greg, I know this is a project you spent a lot of time on. Maybe you could talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, the National Cyber Forensic and Training Alliance is a nonprofit organization based in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where the Postal Inspection Service and FBI share information with local and actually international representatives from academia and private industry. The NCFTA touts about 400 private industry members, largely that want to remain anonymous in their sharing of information with law enforcement. And it gives, as Gary said, an outstanding opportunity for law enforcement to gain access to information that they typically would not want to share outside the confines of their boardrooms, frankly. And we try to make it a neutral environment. The Postal Inspection Service this year is putting about $850,000 into the center. That is a major investment because the Postal Inspection Service doesn't get funding from Congress. We take it from our roles, the consumers of our stamps, and we're putting that into this center because we believe that the center is an outstanding environment for law enforcement to work with industry and academia to understand the problems that are facing our technology infrastructure. I would say that when companies look at how they're going to approach these cyber crimes, they need to look not only how is it going to impact their company, but how is it going to impact their industry. And when one bank is attacked tomorrow, their whatever countermeasure that bank or their competitor applies, it will push the criminals into a different bank in the same sector. And what we're trying to do at the NCFTA is not only look at a particular case and how it's going to impact one organization, but how the cases will impact the entire sector. And we've got several initiatives that we're that are currently engaged at the NCFTA. One is StockAid. And StockAid is basically the brokerage industry coming together to talk about what they're seeing in not only pump and dump schemes, but also how user credentials are being stolen on the internet. How, and for anonymity's purposes, I'll just say XYZ Brokerage, how a particular consumer's username and password to their brokerage account is being compromised and then used to further a criminal scheme. And we also have projects on online pharmaceuticals, as well as spam, as well as a program called ShipperAid that the Postal Inspection Service, working with other private express couriers such as FedEx and UPS, are trying to counter some of the credit card fraud schemes that are out there today. And we're finding that as we look at all these different types of criminality, the criminals that are forcing our hands are impacting each of those different industries. And a pump and dump artist needs a spammer. A spammer needs to be able to get paid. So you might look at a laundering scheme. And the interdependence of those schemes is really the examination and research into those schemes is really providing us with a great environment at the NCFTA.
Keith, is there anything similar at the federal level amongst the agencies, information sharing about attacks that they're seeing? And if so, how is it being used?
Unfortunately, at the federal level, there's a lot of discussion about information sharing, but there's actually, there's four things that have to occur. And the four shuns, I guess they are, the identification, notification, cooperation, and education. Identification is very difficult because there's a great deal of noise going against the federal government. I remember back in, this is 1995 or something like that, I testified for the first time about computer security issues. And, it was an outrage for some people because I talked about the Internet itself as being a place where people can hide. And I gave examples of, in the old days, we called it bobbing and weaving. Now they don't even have to worry about that. And it's very hard to identify the source of the attack. And so what the government has to try and share is the actual structure of the attack. Because the person, for example, let's say your computer is the one that's attacking me. I would say probably 99.999% of the time, you're just a downstream victim. You've been hijacked. And you're not the actual source of it. It may actually be 7 or 8 branches off of the source attack. So, yes, there is a requirement for information sharing in the government. Yes, there is through the Department of Homeland Security. There's the National Cyber Security Group and the Critical Infrastructure Protection. From my standpoint, all I can tell you is that when we go in and test the departments and agencies that we go in and test, we've been doing this now for more than a decade. One, they never stop us. We always get in. Two, they never see us. And three, they don't usually react properly. I mean, I would be happy if the government just slammed the door in my face and hoped that I'd bounced off of them and went down the street and hit some other poor department or agency. But they don't necessarily do that well. I mean, you all can go to the GAO website and you can download all of the reports that we do about the weaknesses in the government. And that's one of the big concerns I have, is that more and more when we go to test a government site, we're testing a commercial site. Because commercial vendor is now the outsource of the back office for the government agency. And whatever you may think about private industry, at least the private industry I test is not very secure. The government's not secure, but the private industry is not very secure either. So don't think because they have profit motive that they're better than anybody else. And because they have money, they're better than anybody else. They have to justify security in a boardroom also. And it's a completely defensive posture. So I would say that there are mechanisms in place to share the information inside the government, but actually having the information to share, a lot of times that's a dry well.
And there was a, I forget what hearing it was I was at recently, but the issue of this information sharing system, it's a system called Einstein, set up to let the government agencies automatically report attacks that they're seeing on their networks. And I think the finding was that not too many agencies were using this this information sharing mechanism.
Well, there's a lot of people, as you've heard, it's not just a commercial event. There's lots of people who just don't want to tell you that, you know, they're having problems. Everyone is, it's not risk management, it's risk aversion. And risk aversion is you do not want to be above the fold on the front page of the Washington Post. No shame to the Washington Post, but if you are a government official, that is not where you want to see your name, unless you're being awarded a medal. If you're being splashed across there because, by the way, you know, 10 million citizen IDs were stolen from your system because somebody swiped a laptop, that's not the place you want to be. And so the information sharing, there's a lot of technology and a lot of advances in technology, and human nature is still human nature. It's kind of hard to overcome a million years of evolution, just making certain that we're all connected.
Well, there's a saying in the computer security field that essentially you don't know what you don't know, and that's often the scariest thing. As bad as things are with cybersecurity that we're hearing about here, how do we know we're not? How do we know it's not a lot worse? Can we trust the systems we're relying on to keep our network safe, and how do we know when those systems fail us?
Brian, it is a lot worse. We'll just use one example. Right now, you're probably familiar with the term botnets. Right now, the largest botnet in history is very active out there. It's called the Storm botnet.
We should probably just explain for, maybe not everybody here knows what a botnet is, but essentially it's a grouping of compromised computers that criminal groups, they're the engine driving all cybercrime today, pretty much. Bad guys can use them to send spam, host phishing sites, and they almost always use them to harvest financial and personal data from infected machines.
Okay. Yeah, thank you for the definition. So once your computer is part of this botnet, your primary job then for your computer is to send spam. The Storm botnet at its peak had 2.7 million computers in it. It was dramatically reduced last month when Microsoft put out a fix that removed a particular version of Storm, and the bad guys released a new version that's not fixed now. Here's the point that we need to be aware of. Consumer education is a major part of the problem. We've told the consumers for years, make sure you have antivirus and make sure it's turned on. Okay. McAfee published a study on October 1st at the kickoff for the National Cybersecurity Awareness Month that showed that 52% of the people who have antivirus products on their computers haven't been updated in 30 days. Brian mentioned earlier, we have hundreds of new viruses being created every day. But it gets worse. If you do have today's antivirus definitions, about one-fourth of all the viruses that you may encounter today are not detected by those antivirus products. The Stormworm, we downloaded samples in our research lab at UAB, and we scanned them with 29 different antivirus products when we download them. And on most days, the version that we download that day is undetectable by every major antivirus product in the United States. So the demo that we did Wednesday of this last week, we downloaded the current version of Storm, and it was advertising itself as a file-sharing network. The other version that's going around right now is a greeting card with a laughing cat on it. I was on a TV show in Birmingham, and the weatherman, as they cut away from our interview, said, "Well, the good thing is I'm not into laughing cats." And on the break, I went up to him, and I said, "Is anyone in your family into laughing cats?" And he says, "My daughter." And I said, "Do you do your banking on the same computer your daughter uses?" You know, and so that, you know, having antivirus doesn't protect you. You have to be a smarter internet user. And I don't know what the message is that we have to give them. If you wait 48 hours, every antivirus product will detect that as malware. But by then, it's too late.
Anybody else want to chime in on that one?
I think that one of the things that we have to be concerned about the bot networks is that if we take, I had a meeting with a very well-known AV firm and one of their researchers, and I said, today, if we went out and said, how many consumers' PCs are compromised? And it's kind of scary. He said 30 to 35%. So let's take 30 to 35% of this room. Your PCs are compromised. Everything you type on that PC is getting captured into a log file, which is typically being harvested by a criminal outside the United States. That's your bank account information. That's your brokerage account information. It's your credit card information. It's all of the emails that you send to your loved ones. And the criminals are selling this stuff by the gigabyte load. You can buy about 5 gig of harvested identity information for about $1,000 US. Imagine how much identity information could be harvested in 5 gigs of information. We're talking thousands and thousands of user IDs and passwords to email accounts, and that's a real concern when we talk about how to protect ourselves against these attacks.
Yeah, I've actually seen some of these caches of stolen data, and Greg's correct. I mean, what was it? I think I saw a cache of around 3,200 victims, and the file was about 2 gigabytes. It was maybe 3 weeks' worth of data stolen.
Well, and the credentials are being sold. We talked about it being automated now. The credentials are being sold in wholesale now. There was a recent arrest in Florida of a family who were had bought $8 million worth of stolen property, or not stolen property. They used stolen credentials to sell $8 million worth of products that they'd bought from Sam's Wholesale Clubs. When they asked them, where did you get the credit cards you were using, they had bought, in one transaction, they had bought 10,000 sets of credit cards in a single transaction.
Two microphones there.
Okay. We'll try it with just one mic. Okay. So this particular family had, for $200,000, purchased 10,000 credit card full sets, Stripe reads, that had been stolen as part of the TJX break-in. In TJX, you remember, they took 46 million credit cards. And so now they're being sold in batches of 10,000.
All right.
Let me also just... There's all kinds of botnets around. one of the other points I would make is that I have enough gray hair to remember a time when there was one telephone company, and you could get your phone in any color so long as it was black, and it was made of bakelite, and it weighed about 750 pounds. So I know no time in my life before the telephone. Well, there's a generation now that knows no time before ubiquity. They live in ubiquity. A colleague of mine has two daughters, and both of them burn up
3,000 text messages a month. And I'm glad he has a bundled service so that he can actually afford that. But the point is, how do you? It's one thing for those of us who've been, you know, toiling in the field of computer security for 10 or 20 or 30 years to understand where we are. Getting to your point about what message do we get out? There's a universe of users out there. I was in the United Kingdom just a little while ago, and I think it was on the front page of, I think it was either the London Times or the Guardian, and they had an article about how young people need to understand what privacy is. They have no grasp of privacy. They may have an understanding of privacy, but they don't understand that when I'm connected, you know, it's nice to have company so-and-so because I can do my text messaging while I'm on the metro, that they may be living in a ubiquitous connection that's completely compromised. And so the reason I make this point is that, one, there's a group of people out there who, in all ages, but there's a, you know, college age, certainly in high school, who don't understand a time before the net, before the web, not just the net. And they need to be educated. And what I think we all need to understand from the opening discussion, there was a mention of the Estonian Spring, the attack against Estonia back in April and May. It's one thing for us to talk about, oh, it was, you know, here's millions of dollars. You have to understand that in Estonia, people couldn't get milk. They couldn't buy gasoline. They couldn't buy bread.
Couldn't go to ATMs.
They couldn't go to their ATMs. They have a national identity card. The identity card has a chip. They have their national banking card. Estonia was a green field. The Berlin Wall falls, Soviet Union collapses, Estonia finds their freedom, and they were a technological green field, so they get to start from scratch and put in the best and connect to everything, and they did. And so at the heart, the attack against Estonia was a distributed denial of service. Part of it, a little bit of it was bots. A lot of it was, as Gadi Evron describes it, he's an Israeli computer security person, he described it as a cyber riot, because people were able to foment anger amongst the Russians against the Estonians because they were going to take down a statue in honor of the Russians, and the Estonians didn't like it, and all this personality fight and all this nationalism came up. And I've heard amongst people in other countries, certainly some of the big ISP runners have said, well, you know, we do battle against the distributed denial of service all the time. They're small potatoes, no big deal. And that's another level of education that we have to do, is that I've been an engineer long enough to know that there's always a loose screw and there's always a bad rivet. And next thing you know, the Titanic sinks. So it's always something small, and everyone says, no, it's the unsinkable something or other. It's this plane will always fly, this ship will always sail, there will always be an England, and the sun will never set on the British Empire. And next thing you know, some little rivet gives way. And that's part of the education, too. There's a great deal of bravado amongst the operators. The operators are absolutely convinced of their superiority because on a day-to-day basis they put up a damn good fight. But I don't know how anyone fares against something like the fight against Estonia. That was an entire nation's infrastructure under siege. It was a cyber invasion. There was one group of people who literally invaded the network of another group of people. And what we have to educate people to in that arena is, all right, it's been proven that it can be done. In internet time and in cyberspace, all you have to do is prove that something can be done, and someone will say, cool, let's perfect it. And that's the message that we need to get across to people. And we need to get across to people that when you live in ubiquity, what do you do if your BlackBerry doesn't work? You know, I don't know that. Can we even find the restroom without a BlackBerry? You know.
Our T-Mobile service was out for 2 hours in Alabama earlier this week. My daughter was going to commit suicide.
I mean, this is that's the direction we're headed. I mean, once upon a time, we always used to joke about the old line, we're all driving to Abilene together. And we were talking about we'd all latched onto a bad idea, but nobody knew that we were going in this direction. Nobody wanted to go to Abilene, but we were all driving there no matter what, because we thought somebody else wanted to go there. Well, in the cyber world, we're all driving to Estonia. I mean, we're all driving to this constant on, constant connected, constant link, and we have to take it seriously.
Well, there's been a lot of discussion here already about the bot problem, and I guess the question I'd like to ask is, how bad is the bot problem right now, and does it make sense to focus a great deal of our law enforcement efforts, our legal attention on the bot problem as a way of addressing cybercrime, or should we be focused on something else?
You want to go, Gary?
Well, I'll start. You can do it more officially. How bad is the bot problem? You know, we talked about Storm briefly, 2.7 million infected machines under one controller. To give you an idea of the volume of noise that can make, our Storm bot network in Birmingham, in my research lab, we've been measuring how much spam can one botnet-infected computer send. Okay, it sends 45 messages every 10 seconds is how much the Storm botnet can send. For one machine, that's 16,200 messages an hour or 388,000 messages a day. Let's say that half of those 2.7 million machines were sending spam, which we think it's far more than half. That's 544 billion spam messages a day being sent just by the StormNet. That's pretty bad. 544 billion messages. Now, that not that many are being delivered because they're sending to randomly guessed addresses, so most of those actually bounce away, but even the bounces hurt. I talked with a major bank yesterday, or not yesterday, it was over the weekend, though, and they said, have you ever heard of a situation where a bank that's being phished is also under denial of service attack? And I said, oh, your mail server, right? And they said, how did you know? The bank is having phishing emails sent out against their bank. What's the return address? support@mybank.com. Where do all those messages go if they don't go to a real address? They bounce. Where do they bounce to? The bank. The bank estimates they were getting 40 million bounced email messages a day. How many messages was the bank equipped to handle? 1 million a day. They had 40 times as many email messages as they could handle, and so the entire bank's email system was down. And they said, what do we do about that? And I said, you sponsor some academic research.
at the University of Alabama.
And I think I'll come in at sponsoring academic research because...
Thank you.
I think that for law enforcement officers to understand what we're up against... probably some of you didn't know what a bot network was before you walked into this room. A lot of law enforcement officers that were training at the academy have no idea what a bot network is. And how do we deal with that from an investigative perspective? How do we identify where the criminal is that's sending these computer viruses out, making the viruses? How are they getting the viruses out to victimize people? And then it's been our experience... And I think it's been hit on in this conversation. There's a lot of dead end points that law enforcement officers are following that don't produce any sort of meaningful leads from an investigative perspective. It's another victim that's at the end of the line that their computer's being used to attack the mybank.com. And the Postal Inspection Service, the FBI, the Secret Service, and the United States Department of Justice's Computer Crime and Intellectual Property Section are looking at some of these issues and trying to figure out where do we invest our resources to be able to maximize the limited amount of investigative resource that is devoted to this in going after leads that are going to result in a criminal behind bars for the conduct that they are doing. And then that gets into another range of a whole range of challenges that deal with the international nature of this criminality, where you've got the criminals that are writing all this all these viruses are sitting comfortably in places like Eastern Europe and the Middle East and Asia. And that brings in diplomatic issues from an enforcement perspective. It brings about a lot of foreign cooperation that approach. I've been to Russia on a number of occasions to try to pursue criminals that are behind writing viruses, that are behind stealing a lot of identity information about U.S. consumers and using it for the wrong reasons. And we find that it's very difficult for the U.S. government to approach in a bilateral situation with the Russian government to be able to effectively get the criminal behind bars. And we've made, you know, we give them nice reports that explain who the criminal is, where they're at, what they are responsible for, but in the end, there's no victim on Russian soil.
Well, and it gets a little worse than that. Postal, I know, was very involved in the Carter Planet bust about 18 months ago. Carter Planet was a online trading room where criminals would go and exchange credit card information that they'd stolen from mostly Americans. It was one of the most successful busts in the history of the cooperation between agencies, and tens of thousands of criminals had their home raided, basically. The head of Carter Planet was arrested. He was taken into custody on foreign soil. 3 weeks later, two cabinet-level officials of this former Soviet republic came in and gave character witness testimony that said that they knew this man was an outstanding individual and he could not be guilty of those charges that had been trumped up by the foreigners, and he was released. All charges dropped. That's a pretty typical outcome for a whole lot of law enforcement effort against these Eastern European countries.
And I think when we talk about what happened in Estonia, and I really liked what you had to say about that, I had worked with the Estonians back in 2004 on an investigation that was one of the primary money launderers for this Carter Planet organization that was out there was in Estonia. And after I got back and the suspect that we were after had been arrested, I got contacted by one of the banks in Estonia that said that they were the victim of a DDoS attack that occurred for 3 days against their particular financial institution. They weren't alone in that DDoS attack. There were other parts of the Estonian infrastructure that had been attacked. And I think that when we talk about Estonia and could it happen to us, there's warning signs that are out there that we need to be reading. This was back in 2004 when I was trying to help the Estonians with this Estonian bank with this DDoS attack. They were out of internet services for 3 days. Their ATM services were down for like a day. And that was just a microcosm of what happened on a major scale several years later. And we just need to be cognizant of the warning signs that are out there.
I'm going to ask a couple more questions, and then I'll open it up to Q&A from the audience. But
It seems a logical question to ask now is, so now that we're at the point where the bot problem has gotten so bad that the bad guys can take entire countries offline, should the government or law enforcement be actively engaged in trying to diminish the number of bots out there? Is that even feasible?
I think that in your earlier question when you said, is it important to go after the bots and the botnet? And the answer, purely from a technical standpoint, I would say yes. Having these networked bots that are taking over multiple machines, you're going to hear horror stories from us about testifying in a courtroom, trying to bring technical evidence to bear, only to be overturned, only to be misunderstood. I had a colleague once, Colonel Bob Giovioni, who used to be the Judge Advocate General for the Air Force Office of Special Investigations, and he had this line, "We're fighting a 21st century crime with 18th century law." And I said, no, crime is crime. The problem I encounter as an expert witness is we're fighting a 21st century crime with an 18th century courtroom. So when I walk in and the judge is wearing a powdered wig and writing with a quill pen, and I'm going to talk about, dueling IP addresses, and the six people in the back row fall asleep into the six people in the front row of the jury, and they haven't even introduced me yet, and I'm already boring them to death, that's the difficulty we're against. So what I would say is let's take a step back and let's take this from a forensic standpoint, and let's take this from a defensive standpoint, and let's take this from sort of a pick-and-shovel standpoint and say, all right, the bots are crushing us. The bots are putting us in a position where we're going to be set up. Let's go after them as best we can, and we'll worry about our failed prosecution later. Let's do what we can on a counteroffensive against them. Now, that does require law enforcement, that does require the government, that does require industry, it does require the citizenry. Your wonderful high-speed internet to your house account just means maybe you get infected a heck of a lot better than somebody on dial-up. If you're not running equipment, if you're not a knowledgeable consumer. So I would say yes, go after the bots, but not necessarily go after them. All deference to my law enforcement colleague who's working nights and weekends to try and solve this problem. Let's go after it as a defensive posture. And if we get a prosecution, swell. If we get good evidence, swell. If we don't, maybe all we do is clean up the collateral damage, because that's what cyber violence, that's what a cyber war is about. It's all about collateral damage.
One thing about going after the bots is that we have the problem with law enforcement and trying to figure out what the crime is here. I work every day with the FBI in the Birmingham office. I'm on the cybercrime task force down there. And as a volunteer, there are a lot of volunteers who are out in professional security positions who are working with law enforcement. I'm a member of InfraGuard. We have 20,000 members who belong to a company. We have security responsibilities in that company, and who joined InfraGuard so that they could share information with the FBI about what they know about cybercrime and other matters, primarily about infrastructure protection, with cybercrime being what binds all the infrastructures together. The thing with that knowledge that the private sector has, we've got to find a way to organize it and present it in a way that brings everything together. I was speaking at the E-Crimes Research Summit in Pittsburgh recently, and I said, here's the research I wish we could be doing. We need research to attribute this stuff. If there's a botnet that has a million members, I've got a million cases of computer intrusion, but how do I show they're all related? I work with a volunteer group called Castle Cops. We, among other things, we run a fishing team called PERT, the Fishing Incident Reporting and Termination Squad. We've looked at 630,000 phishing URLs that people have reported to us. And one of our primary things we're trying to do is tie these things together. Well, one of the other Castle Cops team is looking at spam that's sent by botnets. And what we've started doing with that project, we're trying to tie together what computers are sending which spam campaigns. So we have a list. These 5,500 computers sent My Canadian Pharmacy and U.S. Drugs. These different 5,000 only sent OEM software. They did not send My Canadian Pharmacy. All right, so here's 5,500.